When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 183. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am delighted to be heading east to the fertile fenlands of Cambridgeshire to talk to farmer Tom Clark. Tom, how are you?
Hello, Will. I'm not too bad, and you?
Yeah, very, very well, thank you. Now, Tom, you will be a child of the 80s, like me. Does anyone call you TC, like in Top Cat?
Yes. they did. That was quite a common nickname. You don't hear it so much now.
I'm really pleased about that. And how's harvest going? Is it dragging a bit, like, for me?
It took forever to get going, didn't it? And then we got some in for about 3 days last week, and now it started raining. So yeah, we're actually loading out. We've got a good chunk of it in, but it's a bit frustrating, isn't it, when you have to stop.
Yeah, the fun and games of trying to harvest in the UK. Okay, so I have an advert to read out for Bayer now. Discover your new favourite harvest playlists with all the tracks chosen by growers. Bayer's Harvest Beats playlists on Spotify includes Combine's Roll, a mix of classic tunes to get you singing the harvest in, while the After Dark playlist keeps you motivated and alert with upbeat tunes and classic anthems. Check out Bayer 4 Crops playlists on Spotify now. Tom, what's your favourite song to sing along with on the tractor? Have you got one?
Well, whatever's on, really. I pretty much murder anything.
It's funny. I haven't listened to much music lately on the tractor. I've got sort of much more into audiobooks and podcasts and things. But recently, especially during lockdown, I've kind of rediscovered it. Anyway, there you go, Tom. You were born and raised there on the family farm in Cambridgeshire, right?
No. No, I wasn't. I was so our farm, the farmhouse isn't on the farm. It fell down. Okay. I think my great granddad lived there with my great grandma for a while, and it not fell down.
Okay.
So where we is all old bog around here, and it's not very stable. So
yeah.
So then my great granddad bought a house in Ely, which is the nearby town, about 4 miles away from the farm, and that's I was born there and raised there, but not on the farm as such.
Okay, but did you? I guess sort of slightly removed from being on the farm, but were you, as a child, I guess you were always on the farm, right? Running about?
No. I'm really sorry about that. No, so so my dad was a farmer. Obviously, we knew about the farm. We did come visit, you know, quite a bit, but we didn't, I wasn't, you know, brought up like a farmer's kid.
Okay.
And that's, you know, sometimes I regret that, but my dad was a farmer in the same way my mates, you know, at school had dads who did accountancy or policemen or whatever. So yeah, so it was just another. And my mum also had a different career. She ran a shop in the town, and so, you know, she ran a ladies' underwear shop.
Wow!
So I grew up more in the ladies' underwear shop than I did on the farm.
Much more fun for a young man.
All the same to me.
So you didn't want to be a farmer at all growing up, you know, it never sort of entered your mind?
Oh no, it did. Yeah, no, it did. It was I just assumed at one point I would have to be,
okay.
I think. It wasn't like it wasn't part of my daily life at all. I just thought, and to be fair, my dad was a farmer, but he wasn't on the farm driving tractors every day either. It's quite a big farm. And we had, you know, 15, 20 people working down here. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of extra, you know, didn't rely on me or the family or anything to muck in to get stuff done. If anything, me coming down and demanding to do something on the farm would actually take work away from somebody else. So, yeah, it was a slightly different setup, I guess, than a lot of people have.
Yeah. Okay. So what did you want to do then when you were I mean, you said you maybe had a vague idea that one day you might have to farm, but what did you sort of want to do and think you saw yourself doing when you were left university?
Well, see, I still don't know where I want to be when I grow up.
Me too. Yeah.
But I just really enjoyed school, actually. So I was just really into being at school and learning stuff. And then that carried on into university. And I was just waiting to see what happened, really. And so this is about my fifth career. I've done, you know, lots of things before I came back to the farm. And I've enjoyed all of them. Mm-hmm. But I've also got bored of all of them quicker than I have. And I haven't yet got bored of farming. So it's the one that's stuck about three times longer than anything else.
Yeah. Far. Yeah. Okay. So what did you do at university?
I studied economics.
Okay.
And politics. It was quite a toss up, actually, whether I did that or a biology degree.
Right.
Because I was equally interested in both.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought probably economics would be, I think in the end, I thought it would be more useful. Don't know whether it was. The jury's out. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So where did you end up working? London?
Yes. So I went traveling straight up university because I still hadn't decided what I wanted to do.
Sure.
So, you know, delay as long as possible. And actually had a great year and a bit sort of traveling all around the world.
What was your favorite place you went?
Oh, they're just all so different. And people always ask that. And it's just like apples and pears. You can't really pick anything out. But it's just great to see how different everywhere is. And that is the point of travel. You can't really have a top 10. It's just everything stands on its own merits. But, yeah, so I got back and then I got a job in London. It wasn't actually in the city. It was in one of the suburbs, Kingston upon Thames.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I got a job as a researcher at the local council.
Okay.
Because I guess politics and economics kind of set me up for that. I had already done a bit of work experience in journalism as well.
Okay.
So I've worked for local papers and TV stations. I even spent a couple of weeks at TV stations. I thought that's where I was sort of, I'd try and be a journalist. But then I got sucked into local government. But then in that job, I also dealt with the media as well. So that was kind of useful.
Did you enjoy, I was going to say, the sort of buzz of London life? I guess if you're in sort of the leafy suburbs, it maybe not as much of a buzz as sort of being central, but I guess being a young man living in London must have been fun though.
I had quite an okay yeah. but it was good. I mean, you know, Ely is a small city, and I was at university in Exeter, and that's, you know, that's a city but a bit bigger, but and university life and everything, but I'd never been in London. You know, it's a massive place. And like you say, I thought going to London was going to London, but actually I was sort of living in Twickenham and working in, sort of kind of on the periphery. But even that was, you know, quite a lot more urban than anything I'd been in before. But, you know, that obviously after university, a lot of my mates moved to London, as I guess they all do. And yeah, we were all meeting up in town and stuff. So, yeah, no, it was a great time.
Yeah.
So I worked pretty hard too. So my work days would start at sort of 9 o'clock, but then often finish because council meetings started at 7 o'clock in the evening and often could go in well late into the night. So I worked pretty hard, actually. It was, my job there was sort of supporting the councillors who were sort of running the show. And, you know, they all had jobs and then started their council work in the evening. So I had to do a full day's work and then the action began in the evening. So it was quite late nights and pretty full on. But when you're early 20s, that doesn't really seem to matter. And then the weekend comes and you carry on just as hard.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I thought it was only farmers who worked hard and long hours, Tom. I didn't realise other people did that as well.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Who'd have thought?
It is. So what other roles did you go? I know you did it varying different roles in different jobs in London, various degrees of seniority. What kind of other things did you do?
Yeah, so I got promoted pretty quickly in the job I got into, and I ended up sort of being in charge of the sort of policy forming and strategy and media relations for that council. But then I decided that wasn't really the future I wanted. You know, I would have been like some kind of like Westminster hack. I could quite easily have ended up like that. So I went back to university. I went and did an MBA, Master of Business Administration.
Yeah.
And that took me, I met, you know, some of the best friends I've made in my life, I made on that course. And then I did an extra session in the States as well. So I went over to the States and spent some time over there. And then again, went traveling afterwards. So this is all one long delay to actually settling down. But then when I got back to the UK, I became a management consultant.
Okay.
And then I was living in central London and again, working very long hours. But that was really interesting. It's kind of like being an organizational doctor. So you sort of went around and sort of, obviously people hire you to do something. There's something wrong in their organization or a new strategy that they want to pursue, or something you need to fix, and you go in and you diagnose what's wrong and you talk to loads of people and you come up with solutions and try and put them in place. And that was really interesting. That was fascinating. It's kind of, for about 5, 6, 7 years, that was really was, you know, what my life was about, kind of like,
yeah.
I wanted finding problems and finding ways to fix them. And dealing with people as well. So
yeah,
that was really fascinating. But it was towards the end of that time, I had become a bit jaded, because you don't really get to pick which problems you fix. Your bosses put you on projects and things like that. And, you know, I had become a little bit jaded with some of the things that I had to do. And it's, you know, it's being part of a massive organization like that. And Windows. So I worked for Accenture and then Deloitte. You know, there's tens of thousands of people work for that organization, mm-hmm. and you are a tiny cog in the wheel. I mean, a tiny cog in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a certain element that you can, you know, you're there because you're good at what you do. But then there's quite a lot of it is you're there to do what you're told as well.
Sure.
And I just was starting to feel like maybe I could do something a bit more out on my own. But then my dad died. Well, he got sick and then died. And he obviously, third generation farmer, and there was no one else really to sort of to pick up the pieces. So actually, that's when I moved back to the farm.
So did you, when your dad first became ill, were you thinking then, now's the time then? Now I might have to move back to the farm. Was that in your mind then, or was it?
Yeah, well, if he was, well, so I took a leave of absence to start with, because I couldn't really focus on what I was doing, because my dad was, he'd been hiding how ill he had been from everybody, and then when it all came to a head, it came to a head quite quickly.
Farmers tend to do that, don't they?
He certainly was that. Mm-hmm. In that mold.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I took a leave of absence just to basically, you know, be there, mm-hmm. to try and convince him to go to the doctors, and then make sure he kept going to the doctors, and actually sort of he wasn't able to be out and about and run the farm and stuff. So, and I didn't know anything about it, but I knew that I could help. So I was there doing that. But he died pretty quickly. He died within 6 months. So, and then there was no one else to carry on. I mean, all the crops had just been planted. It was February, so things were in the ground, and you know, I needed to stay and see it through. So, and that's really how I got into farming. So that for the first time in my life, you know, I'd been on the farm longer in those 6 months than I had been in the whole rest of my life. But that was, you know, even then my dad was, he was quite a control freak, to be honest. So even then I didn't really know how anything was to work. I was passing on his instructions and things like that. And, you know, I knew how to run a business, but I had no idea about how the farm itself worked. Crop growing crops and stuff, so I was quite in at the deep end.
I guess though, with what you'd been doing as a management consultant and sort of almost going in to businesses with that outside pair of eyes and immediately looking at what needs to change, I guess that must have stood you in very good stead for that situation going into the farm, did it?
Well, I thought it would. you know, there was nothing I couldn't do. You know, it was great. I'd been in, I'd sort, you know, helped out sort the Olympics and DEFRA and, you know, job seekers, job centres and things like that. You've been sort of, you know, and some of the work I'd done have been going into really small micro charities who had been given national lottery funding and didn't have a plan for when that money ended and stuff. So I always thought, I can do anything. You know, I can I can go to blue chip companies and government departments and tiny charities that employ one person, and you know, I can help everybody, so the farming is going to be easy. And it's all very different. It's all very different when you are in charge rather than you being paid for your advice, and when you're trying to take, you know, responsibility for a business where things have been done in a certain way for a long time, and all the people who live and work in the farm have been used to a certain style their whole lives, not just, you know, jobs. So yeah, I mean, farming is a unique industry in lots of ways. And I pretty much, yeah, no, my cockiness. Well, I mean, obviously I was dealing with grief and all the other stuff as well, and a complete lack of knowledge. But what I wasn't worried about, and probably should have been more worried about, was that I didn't know what I was doing. But at the time, it didn't seem, you know, didn't occur to me that I wouldn't be able to cope with anything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's, no, anyone who thinks taking on a farm from scratch is a simple thing is mistaken.
Yeah.
No matter how clever you've been, and whether you've, you know, used to talking to chief execs and all the rest of it, yeah, it took me 5-6 years really to feel like I knew enough to do things differently.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. I mean, I guess you didn't have, you obviously didn't have long, did you, for that transition while your dad was around? You didn't have long for him to pass on what you needed to know, I suppose. Very short time, I guess.
No, and we didn't really know he was going to die until about 2 weeks before he did. So even then, we were planning to, like, he might be out of action while he had an operation or while he was having chemotherapy and stuff, and I would be holding the fort, rather than, we didn't really have a succession plan as such. So it was all done at speed and very late in the day. But, and, you know, a lot of it had to be sorted out after he's died as well. So, yeah, no, it really was in at the deep end. And, of course, I just moved in with my girlfriend in London, you know, just before Dad got ill. So I think she moved into my flat. And then 2 weeks later, I took a leave of absence from work and went and lived on the farm. So, yeah. And bless her, you know, we're now married. So we've been married now 12 years. So, that would bless her for sticking with me through that too.
Yeah. So what's been, I mean, you said it took you 5 or 6 years before you felt confident enough to make any changes, but what's been the most difficult aspect of it? Is it as in the change of what you were doing to running a successful farm business? What's been the most difficult aspect of it for you?
Well, I think there's so much. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. The easiest part was looking at the accounts, running the business, thinking about cash flow, all of that sort of stuff. Didn't bother me. Inheriting the workforce, I mean, all of them had been there for so long and had only known my dad as their boss. And they really didn't know what to make of me. You know, they didn't really know me, and I just turned up and suddenly I was in charge. And, you know, my dad had, very different. I couldn't have been a control freak type of farmer, even if I'd wanted to have been, because no. So, and they had been used to my dad giving, you know, very specific, and, you know, he wanted things done the way he wanted done. Yep. He wasn't a great sharer of forward plans and stuff. So day to day, they would be hanging on his every word to find out what they would be doing every day. And so, and I turn up and I say, right, what do you think you should do today? What's next? And they all thought I was trying to catch them out. You know, they all thought, well, you know, if I give you the wrong answer, are you going to sack me? So that was, you know, building trust. A way of communicating, because, you know, I'd been used to sort of management speak. And sort of putting things in documents and handing them out and stuff, that just none of that applied at all. You know, it was just conversations around the back of the shed, and not sure what I was saying or whether I was saying the right thing, and whether the guys on the farm understood what I meant or thought it was right or wrong, because really they were much more expert in all of this. So I just very quickly, I was just like, look, you guys, you know, I'm really not trying to trick you. I just don't know what to do. So, you know, you guys know what to do. You know, you've been doing this, you know, I think the shortest time that I got three full-time employees I inherited, and the one that had been there the least amount of time had already been there for about 12, 15 years. So, they all knew what to do. And my agronomist as well had been on the farm. He's an independent agronomist, and he'd been working for my dad since he was 23.
Okay.
And so he knew all the fields, he knew all the crops, the history and everything, and I knew nothing about growing crops at all. So I was very reliant on him and the staff. And basically I followed my agronomist around like a little puppy for 5 years. every time he came on the farm, I was like running after him up the field. What's that? What's this? How do we do that? What's that? And then, so I learned on the job and from the guys who'd been doing it all really, before I did anything else. That was obviously such a big learning curve. Mm. And I guess that was the hardest thing, but mm-hmm. All three of them stayed with me. One is now retired. Sadly, one of them died earlier this year, and one of them's still working for me. So it's been all right. We got through it, and the agronomist is still with me, and I didn't piss them off. Well, we managed to find a way through.
It's a bit like this sort of fresh-faced Sandhurst graduate turning up and trying to deal with grizzled NCOs, isn't it? I guess it's similar.
I imagine it's very similar, yeah.
Yeah.
Only less substance to me than the Sandhurst officer.
Do you, I guess conversely though, it's also a good thing, isn't it? You've got that different perspective. I mean, my experience very different. You know, I left school very early, went home to work on the farm, and it was only later that I realized I kind of made a mistake with that and sort of deliberately tried to find other experiences, because I realized that it wasn't a good thing to just go straight to a family farm. And you know, and I think perhaps that way of thinking is becoming more common now, that people perhaps should go away for at least a few years before they come back to the family farm. So, you know, I guess you also had that as well, didn't you? That different experience and different way of thinking.
Yes, and actually coming back to the farm was something completely different as well. I mean, I think if I had probably still a flaw, it's getting bored too easily with things and wanting something different, something to change. And actually, I had got a lot of that out of my system already by the time I went onto the farm. And actually, the farm itself, I mean, I said it was a steep learning curve, and it sounds awful. You know, my dad died and I had to, you know, but actually, it was one of the great things that helped me through losing my dad, actually, was actually this massive new challenge and new things to learn and pick up and try to understand. And that was a massive help to me and, you know, a great new purpose in my life, if you like. So I fell in love with farming pretty quickly, even though I wasn't very good at it, probably still not. It's there's nothing like it, you know. The farming is... And maybe you do appreciate that more, having come to it from away first. But it's nothing like farming. You're your own boss, and you're at the mercy of the weather for a great deal of things. But the things that things that you can control are. So this was another big challenge: is that it takes so long. You know, you take a whole year to do one piece of work. So if you like, so I mean, I was used to projects turning around in weeks, and you know. Weekly deadlines and you know, maybe do something completely different the month after you started something else, you know. So things moved a lot more quicker, more rapidly. Decisions in some ways got made a lot quicker. But farming, obviously, it takes, you have to plan your rotation. And if you want to do something different, you've got a small window to actually decide what you want to do. But then it takes maybe 2 years to you find out whether that was the right decision or to assess whether it was good or not. And then if you want to change on that, you know, so 5 years in farming, I guess, isn't very long, really.
No, not
so that was a really different way of working, and it slowed me down and made me probably more careful and deliberate about what I was doing than some of the stuff I'd done before.
Yeah.
Which is all very intense and high pressured and stimulating like that. But this is really nurturing. It's a really nurturing industry. You know, you have to really sort of get into the bones of it, really. And you do have the time to do that, and yeah, I really love it now.
Did you And I know we can all, and I'm probably one of the worst for this, for over romanticizing farming and family farms. I try not to, but you know, I do think there's something in it, though it can perhaps be overdone. But did you feel that sort of, especially with losing your father, and it's a multi-generational family farm, did you feel that sort of sense of legacy and carrying it on, or was that something that never entered your mind?
Absolutely. I mean, it was, I mean, it's an intense privilege, isn't it, to be able to have, I mean, I wouldn't be a farmer if at all. I don't see how I could have been if I hadn't inherited the farm, basically. And of course, I'm getting a bit teary now, but, you know, I mean, my great-grandparents started the farm, mm-hmm. and it's been passed down, you know, three generations.
Mm.
I didn't want to be the one that cocked it all up.
Yeah.
And you know, you're given this. It's a very big privilege to be able to do it, but it's also a massive responsibility. And you just, I'm a bit lost for words because it's something so visceral. I feel it really inside me now, mm-hmm. and it's kind of irrational. Because at the end of the day, it's also just a business, and it needs to make money, and it's just producing a product. But yeah, no, it's something very deep.
I think it is. It is hard to put into words, isn't it? Because as you've said, it is a business. We've all got to make money and look at the opportunities. But yeah, I've tried and failed to write something about this because it's hard to not go overly romantic when you talk about it. But you're right; it is deep inside you, I think, isn't it? It's certainly something I feel.
Yeah, but I also feel that is part of the problem.
Yes.
I feel it deeply, and I value it immensely. But I one of my things I say is that farming is actually a caste rather than a career.
Yeah.
I think, and you're born into it, and leaving it or not doing it is almost leaving your family.
Mm.
But that does, I think, is farming wouldn't be the way it is now if that sort of vocational, intrinsic part of it wasn't there.
Yeah.
But then there are farms, obviously, which are run much more like businesses. There are businesses which are farming businesses as well, too. But yeah, you wonder how much of it is done out of tradition when it should be more commercially focused. And I can point that accusation right at myself as well.
Because
you know, it might have made a lot more sense just to sell the farm and let someone else who knew what they were doing farm it. It might even be the case that I should do that right now. And there's things which aren't necessarily logical which hold you back from doing that.
So tell us about the farm itself, because the Fens are a unique area really of the UK. Now for hill and valley dwellers from the west of the country like me, or people who may live abroad who are listening, describe the landscape there and how it all works.
I'll start with a little anecdote, because when I moved to London, my girlfriend, and she lives in quite a hilly, she was born and bred in London, she lives in quite a hilly part of London, and she had to teach me how to use a handbrake. I didn't understand what they were for. so basically, you can just stop your car and it doesn't go anywhere.
You won't be surprised that that's the first thing I learned to use on our car.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's, there are no hills. Well, there are what we call hills, but which I get scoffed at for calling hills. But so this, the whole of the Fens was basically a marsh or bog, and was drained from, well, the Romans had a go, but from about the 1600s onwards. And it's obviously settled. It was settled, and it's settled according to gravity, pancake flat. So, it used to be above sea level, but as it's settled down and then dried, it has shrunk. So that actually now our farm is 2 meters below sea level, which a lot of people, well, why aren't you under the sea there? If you're below sea level, okay, it's just like a bowl. so the rim of the bowl does go up again when you get to the sea, but where we are is down, and it's constantly drained to keep it free of flooding, because left, I think, I heard recently of authorities, sources, that it would take 7 to 12 years of normal rainfall and without the drainage system for the fens basically to fill up with fresh water.
Okay.
Again, so yeah, so it's really flat, and obviously it was enclosed through the 1600s, 1700s, and the fields, it was a blank canvas, so all the fields are quite square and there's a lot of straight lines. We don't have any hedges or hills. All the fields are surrounded by drainage dikes, mm-hmm. Or ditches, which basically all the fields drain into the ditches, and the ditches all come together into what we call drains, and these are then pumped. So the whole of the landscape is mechanically, artificially pumped. And so all the water gets pumped up into the rivers. So the rivers are above the level of the land with these enormous levees either side of the rivers, and then they run out to sea when the tide's out. So it's basically, it's like a small part of Holland.
Yeah.
Yeah, and only they are a lot lower below sea level than we are. And the soils are very fertile because they've had all this, you know, organic matter in them. So ours are made of mostly of peat, and it's not like acidic peat you get up on the Peak District in the hills. It's more alkaline peat. And it's, so our soils are from 20 to 30+% organic matter.
Wow.
They look black from coffee grounds, black right through to charcoal black, in places. And they're quite deep, you know, so we plow, if you plow, you can plow, some of it's what they call bottomless. So you don't hit anything else except the fluffy stuff. Yeah, so it's a very different landscape. It's, you know, there's a lot of horizontal lines and big skies, and we get amazing 360-degree sunsets. So when the sun's setting on one side of the horizon, the light from the sunset's reflecting off the opposite horizon's clouds. So it's kind of all around, and it's very windy too. So there's nothing to stop the wind.
No. Yeah. No, I drove through it a couple of years ago, and it's not the part of the country I know very well, but it is a really different landscape to the rest of the UK, and I was quite, you know, I'm relatively well traveled around the UK, but it's just not an area that I know particularly well, and going through I was really struck how different the landscape is. So it's yeah, I was really sort of interested by it and how it all works.
And when I was young, I just think, oh, it's so boring. It's just so flat and there's nothing to see.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people think that of the fence. It's flat and boring, but it is definitely flat. But I've learned it's not boring at all. It's, you know, there's so much going on. And you just, you know, when you're driving through the hills or something like that, you get to see, you know, it's pointing at you because it's up and you can see across the landscape. Here, it's all linear, it's almost two-dimensional. You can't see it, so it's easy just to dismiss it. But there's so much going on, and so much wildlife, and the landscape is quite man-made, like you say. It feels artificial, but there's so much more to it than that. And I've become a great evangelist for the fens. But yeah, you're right. I think there's a bit down the Somerset levels and the Humberhead levels and Isle of Axholme, and there's mm-hmm. places like that. But I think this is the biggest area anywhere like this in the UK.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you imagine Netherlands, Holland, your listeners must have get an idea in their heads for what it looks like.
Yeah. And peat, you mentioned the peat soils. Peat, very much in the news at the moment, probably never been in the news on the front pages, really, of not just farming press, but mainstream press as well. You are involved with the Fenland Peat Committee as well. Tell us about some of the work you do with that, and why peat is so important.
So peat is basically the undecomposed plant matter that has been preserved by being wet. So then it's sort of without oxygen underwater, and it's pickled, basically pickled by water. So when it dries out, it's this very fertile black soil now, and it's black because it's made of basically carbon. But when it dries out and the air gets to it, it does start to oxidize, and carbon and oxidation makes carbon dioxide. So dry peat soils emit carbon dioxide, and as we know, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and that's a really pressing problem, and not least here where we're already 2 meters below sea level and having to pump all our water out up into the sea, you know, that's a real issue for us. So something we take seriously. It's our livelihoods as well. But the impression that a lot of people have is that farming peat is just bad, because you know, when you till the soil, and even not just tilling the soil, just having it dry,
yeah,
means it's emitting carbon dioxide and contributing therefore to climate change. So this was tried to be quantified, how much the Cambridgeshire Fens, and Cambridgeshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, Lincolnshire Fens are emitting carbon dioxide, and it came up with a figure which is pretty scary.
Okay.
It's like 3 million tonnes or something of carbon dioxide every year emitted from the Fens. So there's a lot of calls from NGOs to sort of basically, the only way you can stop it completely is to re-wet, and that would mean the end of farming the Fens. Now, the Fens is exceptionally productive land. I think we're about 3% of the UK land area, but we produce 7% of our food and nearly all of our fresh vegetables and things like that. And so obviously then where's that going to come from? Are you importing it from places that are even worse? So there's all that sort of calculation. But the Fen and Peat Committee has been put together by the Independent Climate Change Committee for Cambridgeshire to really look into this particular issue, because Cambridgeshire is quite good for carbon, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, apart from the peat, which really ruins it and makes it the worst in the whole country.
Yeah.
So what we've been looking at is the extent to which the figures which are out there are actually backed up by evidence. And it turns out that a lot of the maps that have been used, you know, date from the 60s, and there's a lot of the science behind it is kind of not up to date.
Yeah.
Because obviously. And so actually, so there's the things called flux towers. Do you know what a flux tower is?
I don't know.
So a flux tower is a piece of kit which measures the amount of greenhouse gases that are emitted from a piece of land. And I haven't had this verified, but someone said that the Fens has the highest concentration now of flux towers in the entire world. So I think we've got something like 30 odd flux towers across the Fens.
Just measuring that down so I can have a look at them later.
Yeah, so they're measuring the amount of carbon dioxide that comes out of the ground. And we are trying to baseline everything. We're remapping. We're using farmers' knowledge. To obviously, farmers know their fields. They know which bits are black. So a lot of the argument is that a lot of the peat has already gone. It's been wasted, and there's only a small area of what they call deep peat left, which is, you know, over 40 centimeters deep. And the old maps just basically colour in the whole of the Fens the same. So we might have, you know, a lot of the carbon dioxide emissions have been made already.
Sure.
And then there's an argument to finding out, well, if you're irrigating the land, because a lot of potatoes and things are growing around here, are you keeping it wet? Does that mean you're actually emitting less carbon dioxide than you would be? If it's mixed in with the underlying subsoil, does that sort of stabilize it? Does that mean it's emitting less? All of this work's going on. And then we're also looking at ways to carry on farming, but by mitigating the amount of carbon dioxide that gets in. So whether we could use wet fallows, so basically flooding fields for a year to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that emitted as well, or raising the water, because we control the water table, obviously, because it depends on how much you pump out. So whether we could cope with raising the water table to keep more of the peat wet and all of this sort of stuff. And there's nature-based solutions as well, and then rewilding as well. And all of that is all wrapped up in this Fen and Peat Committee, which is made mostly of farmers, but also NIAB and the county councils and lots of other organisations, wildlife trusts, who are all kind of working towards the same thing, to keep this as a working landscape that people depend on this for their livelihood, and it produces stuff that people value, but at the same time without wrecking what's left and without contributing to climate change any more than that's absolutely necessary.
Yeah. So I find what you've said there to be quite exciting, really, in a way that's a lot of people recognizing that there's a problem and trying to work together to sort it out, but also recognizing, as you've said, that is a vitally important food producing part of the UK, and that's that you know, I don't say that lightly, because for a long time we have struggled to work together to find a solution for things like that, I think, haven't we? But I do think we are getting better at it. So, you know, something like that, I think, is a really great example of that to me.
Well, I hope so. I mean, and I do. I mean, that's one of my drums I keep on banging, is that we, you know, farmers don't have anything to fear from these agendas. You know, we just have to go out there. And a lot of people don't understand why we farm.
Or
if we need to, where food comes from. And it's not just food, it's landscape, it's the biodiversity that we have as well. And actually, we just need to get out there and engage and communicate. And from that comes understanding and cooperation. And you know, I've changed my view about things as well. I mean, it's not that everyone suddenly comes around to your point of view.
No.
You take part in a conversation and you end up better informed as well. And the solutions you come to are ones that hopefully — we're not there yet, so I'm preempting — but, you know, hopefully the solutions we do come to are ones that everyone can buy into. But obviously, with our involvement, they're more likely to suit us than if we're just ignoring it or negative or defensive about it.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. So what crops are you growing there on the farm in these rich Cambridgeshire fenland soils?
So around here, there's a lot of veg growing. So there's a lot of salad veg, so lettuce, celery, beetroot, carrots, but on our farm in particular, we don't grow that. It's a lot, you know, there was one or two really big operations that do that, and we are anywhere near big enough to do that. So we have what they call the typical fenland rotation, which is root crops and cereals, basically. So we grow sugar beet, potatoes. We used to grow carrots, although we don't anymore, and onions, and then you sort of have a cereal as a break crop in between them, usually wheat. Not a lot of malting barley gets grown on the fen because it's such high nitrogen
that
often make a malting grade. But then, so this year, for the first year, I've grown oats, which is something I thought only used to grow in Scotland. You know? So that's interesting. And we grow linseed as well as a break crop. And wheat is the main. So it's something and then wheat, something and then wheat, something and then wheat. And that's really what we did. I used to grow peas. I don't grow them anymore, but it's something I might get back into. The problem we have on the fen is everything grows too tall and falls over, and also that includes the weeds.
Okay.
So the weeds love it here. If we could grow, I just had one field, a small field of oats. We just tried to combine the other day, and it was terrible. It's full of mugwort. And my sister, who is into these things, told me that it's a massive herb in Chinese medicine. And I was suddenly thinking, oh, maybe I could harvest that and sell it to the Chinese. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
So there's lots of opportunities. Basically, there's nothing we can't really grow. I mean, in terms of, it's all grade one agricultural soil. But yeah, there's choices to be made about, you know, that, what that means in terms of your kit, your workforce. We used to grow potatoes here off our own back. But I now do all that through a joint venture with a neighbour, because it's quite a labour intensive thing to do. And, you know, the kit you have to get invested in is quite a lot. So those decisions, rather than the soil type, is sort of what determines your crops. Whereas I guess everywhere else, it's more determined with what you can grow.
Yeah. It's funny you should say that, because we have having tremendous problems with Himalayan balsam at the moment. Grows in huge quantities along the banks of the river here, and rapidly spreading out into the field. So I've been looking on the internet to see if I can do something with
it.
Anyway, just looking on the internet there like it's the 90s. One thing we sort of mentioned at the beginning was that you grew up sort of not living on the farm itself, and you still don't. You still live off farm, right? It's quite unusual, isn't it, really? For, you know, that is, I think, I don't, I'm trying to think if I've interviewed any other farmers who don't actually live on the farm. I don't think I have. So you're very special, Tom.
Yeah, so I not only don't live on the farm living 4 miles away in Ely, which my dad did, but I live off the farm living 74 miles away in London.
Yeah.
And that is... it's crazy, really. I mean, obviously, we've got no livestock. The potatoes don't need milking, you know. So, but Yeah, so obviously I came back to the farm having been in London, and as I mentioned, I sort of was living with my girlfriend there. We're now married, but she was born and raised in London. And all our friends were in London. And to start with, there was nowhere really for me to live other than moving back here with my mum when my dad died. So I was there a lot, but I was still going back to London for weekends. And as I got more up to speed with what I was doing, I needed to be here less, because obviously I still had three full-time people working on the farm doing, yep. I mean, I still really can't drive a tractor. I've taken all the courses and I can do a bit of power harrowing and I can cart wheat just about. I can't really reverse a trailer into a building. And really, my job here really is kind of running the farm rather than doing the farming. So I'm not really what you call a proper farmer in that way. So life carried on, and my wife runs a business of her own in London, which is property based as well. So, you know, and she works full time, and actually she earns five times what I do. So it's it was never really. And we live 20 minutes from her office in London. So it was never really, so let's move to the countryside. This is someone you'd be telling who's born and raised in London that she has to come and live out in Cambridgeshire and commute to London every day to earn all the money. So, and actually the way I've worked it is we're on the right side of London. So it's only about an hour and a half's drive up to the farm. And I come here, I've been here now for the longest time, I think in years. I've been here now for a week and a half to the harvest without break. But that's not usually I'm up here one or two nights a week, and I'm here sort of three or four days out of the week, but you know, we've got kids now, they're at school in London, and you know, it's really where the family home is. And as I say, my wife is the main breadwinner, so this is my I'm a part-time farmer, hobby farmer if you like, but
I don't know, you sometimes think, see, you know, you hear people talk about, you know, a real farmer. I'm not really sure what a real farmer is. I mean,
I'm sure when I had this conversation over and over, Stuart Roberts, who's the deputy president of the NFU, also said he lives quite close to London, and I think there's a lot of commuters that live in his village or near his farm, and he says that, you know, when they all meet up and the pub, all they want to talk about is the farmer.
Yeah, you know,
there's judges and stuff. And people find it massively interesting.
Yeah.
And I get that conversation all the time, but there's always that, I can't count how many times I've had to have that conversation where, oh, so what do you do? What do you work at? And I say, I'm a farmer. It sort of goes quiet in the room. It's like, oh, we're in London. And I have to go through this whole, the farm's not in London, the farm's in Cambridgeshire. And oh, but so do you have animals? You know, it's the same thing over and over. But yeah, so that is what I mean. I'm always having to explain how I'm a farmer rather than it just being obvious. And that's what I mean by I'm not a proper farmer, because I don't have animals, which most people think I do. I don't live on the farm, which most people think a farmer does. I really drive a tractor, which is what most people think farmers do. So whatever most people think a farmer is, I'm really not.
Yeah. Well, if it's any consolation, I've had people say I'm a part-time farmer just because I do a farming podcast and do other things as
that.
Well.
I've heard
as
that
well,
too.
As well. So there you go. One thing I did want to ask you about is that you do a lot of stuff for nature and environment on your farm, part of the current higher level scheme. And you're also part of the Ely Nature Friendly Farming Zone. That sounds really interesting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so actually my dad, I guess as we've got fewer and fewer people on the farm had got less and less tidy. You know, they used to, you know, if there was spare work labour, the foreman used to send out people to sort of fork the edges of the fields, you know, keep it really and everything mown. Yeah, yeah. But then over time, it's got a lot less tidy. And so when I inherited it, there were all the margins were around all the fields next to the dikes, because that's where he put his set-aside. And then he hadn't got rid of it when the set-aside thing was taken away. And so we were kind of pre-made for ELS, at least.
Yeah.
So I entered that. And then the RSPB got their hooks into me and convinced me to go for HLS, which is, you know, they're pushing on an open door, really. I was quite into doing that stuff for nature. And you know, it makes sense, too, because there's bits of, even out here, there's bits of fields that are the wrong shape or aren't as fertile or productive and stuff like that. It made sense to just get paid for doing something else on those bits of land. So that's how I really came into the HLS. We've been in that now, actually ends next year. It's 10 years that we've been in that. But then also all the prescriptions that you get in these environmental schemes are kind of set up for, I guess, sort of more sort of clay soils and upland, what we would call up. Everything's upland apart from here. So, and the soils we have and the landscape we have is so different from that, that a lot of the prescriptions and stuff just didn't make sense. And the way they tell you have to manage them just don't work. So one of the things we needed to do was I needed to learn from my neighbours who had been, some people around here have been in these schemes for 20, 25 years. And we started talking, and the RSPB again sort of stepped in and sort of started coordinating that. And we have grouped together as a group. We're now 22 local farmers, and we set up what we call the Ely Nature Friendly Farming Zone, which is a bit of a mouthful. But when nature friendly farmers, we want to show that we can, and again, back to this perception of the fens as being this flat, boring, almost industrial food production area. And a lot of the people who live in the towns and villages around here have no connection to farming either. And so if that perception's allowed to grow, they've got no stake in this being a farming landscape. So we wanted to try and communicate that, you know, not only it's flat, but it's not boring, and that there's a lot of stuff going on here in terms of nature and all the rest of it. So this group came together to learn from each other in terms of how to do this better, to bring in outside experts so that we learn new stuff and more at the cutting edge of trying to make this work. But then thirdly, also to communicate what we're doing to the outside, the non-farming world. That's really, we had a bit of a hiatus and to be honest, the only thing that actually made it happen was the RSPB providing a coordinator to come in and put the time in to go and speak to every single farmer and make us do stuff, because it's so easy just to get blinkered and tunnel vision on your own land. And it's so time consuming to go around every other farm to get it. So they helped set us up. And then unfortunately, the amazing guy called Andrew Holland, who did that, left to go somewhere else. And we were in this sort of lull, but now they've come back in. And then we had coronavirus as well. But now they've come back in with a new, and we were sort of re-energized and revitalized, and we're out and about again. And we're looking at, so interestingly, that whole theme has quite nicely fitted into the things that DEFRA are now talking about for the new environmental land management schemes around landscape scale recovery and collaboration among farming groups as well. So we're hoping to sort of evolve towards that as well. So we might be able to do things more together on this than we could do singly and benefit from it together in ways which we wouldn't be able to do if we weren't working together as well.
For sure. I mean, I guess exactly that. It goes back to what we said about the Peak Committee. You know, it's amazing what we can do when we work together. So what are your hopes for the new environmental land management schemes? I mean, it's something that's, you know, been talked about now for the last 3 or 4 years as we move out of a subsidy system in the UK. But what are your hopes for it? And do you think they're going to get it right? The government.
I have mixed feelings about this. I think I have more fears than hopes. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when it was all set out at the Oxford Farming Conference by Michael Gove, all this public money for public goods, it seemed like a sensible sort of way forward. You know, you got to justify to the taxpayer why farmers are getting subsidies. Let's pay them for the things that they wouldn't be providing otherwise.
Yeah.
But of course, the principle is potentially sound. The devil is in the detail, and the detail is what we haven't seen yet. It's very refreshing. So the DEFRA are taking this co-design approach, by which they mean they're not going to design it and then tell us what it is. They actually want farmers to get involved with how it's designed, and they're piloting everything. But I think that makes it much more complicated, and that's part of the reason why we haven't seen a lot of the detail. And obviously our subsidies, so that we used to get paid, obviously for people who don't know, is we used to get paid an area, so it's however much area you had on the farm, you got paid a certain amount just for having that as farming land. And that's being phased out, and it'll be halved for most farmers by, you know, in 2 years' time, by 2024. And then that money will be redirected through this new being paid for producing public goods.
Yep.
But yes, obviously, when you're doing that, the provision of public goods isn't going to be as uniform as the distribution of land. So there's obviously going to be winners and losers from the new system. And I have a feeling, and possibly this is right, that there'll be more losers than winners overall, and that actually a lot of the money will be focused on those farms where really the public goods is the one of the main things that they're producing, rather than an additional thing to food as well. But my fear then is that in places like this, the logic then would mean that, okay, so you're not getting paid any subsidy, or not significant subsidy, because you're not producing particularly that many public goods, and you don't have the sort of resources or ability to really sort of make that up. So it's not really worth the candle. Then UK farming will be forced down this. Well, it's not forced. It would just be the logical choice.
Yeah.
Will be then to maximise the productivity of the farm, or not even the productivity, but the amount of food. And for the lowest cost. So there's a risk that actually a policy designed to produce the provision of public goods actually does that, but at the same time it also increases the amount of public bads well.
Public bads.
I think that's a very interesting, interesting policy problem.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. And I speak to obviously lots of different farms, and I think lots of them have those concerns to varying degrees, no matter where they're farming in the country. And certainly I have those up here as well. It very similar concerns. It would be very easy to think that you with everything you have going on and back and to the farm, that and then the boards you've mentioned, you've already said that you don't have time for anything else, but you do find some time for other things, and you involve quite a few different wider industry roles, which we'll go into in a minute. But why do you, I guess, when you first came back to the farm, I suppose you would have been very focused on learning how to be a farmer and run the business, but when did you take the decision to sort of try to get involved in the wider industry, and why is that important to you?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that was my focus for the first few years. I didn't know what I was doing, so I had to learn about it. But then I guess 5 or 6 years in, as I said previously, I get bored quite easily. And you know, it wasn't the question I could just not farm anymore. Mm-hmm. And the more I got sort of things under control here, the more time I had anyway, because I wasn't massively trying to learn stuff. So I did have more time available. And it just seemed like the natural next thing to do. Having studied economics at up to degree level, one of the things farming is often a special case because of the way it's set up. You know, farmers don't have a lot of market power. We are price takers, and costs often get pushed down onto us. And it was obvious to me that, you know, to do more, to make my business better, I was reliant on farmers generally in the industry being able to work together and change the economics of farming that way. And obviously that is still very much a work in progress. But so I think any farmer that has time to spare or expertise to bring or insights to bring should get involved in the wider industry, because the basics of farming relies on that. We can't just be really good at our businesses, because we're little boats on the sea. You know, we are pushed wherever the market and the economics take us. So things like the NFU, things like the NFU Sugar Board, which is where I'm mostly focused on, cooperatives, buying groups, all of that sort of next level up from the farm gate is really where the future of farming has to be, because just being really good on your farm is never going to be enough to make it sustainable across the future. I mean, if everyone else in the world was as small as, you know, every other business in the world was as small and dependent on the markets as we are, things might work out. But the fact is, farmers are so small, but we face these massive corporations, mm-hmm. our suppliers, land ownership, if you like, as well, but also our buyers and the retailers and everything else. We just can't stand up to that. And that is why farming has always been having its any benefits we get, however good we get, all those gains are taken from us into the market and actually to the point where it becomes unsustainable and we're having to be supported by subsidies. It's ridiculous. It's kind of an obligation. I mean, just I'm naturally interested in it anyway, and I'm, as I say, bored and prone to try and get involved with stuff anyway. So that's my natural disposition. But yeah, so I started thinking about that, and that in sugar beet in particular, because we have this unique setup in the UK where half the market is domestic grown sugar, and there is only one processor, which is British Sugar, and it's kind of a monopoly buyer, and there are 3,000 odd sugar beet growers in the country, and uniquely by statute, so it's in the law that there is this designated representative of those sugar beet growers, which is NFU Sugar, and they have, by law, British Sugar has to conclude a contract with NFU Sugar on behalf of all of those growers. So that seems like a really good, and interesting place to start trying to contribute. So that's, I've been on the board now for, I think I joined in 2017, and for 2 years I was co-opted, and then I was elected 2 years ago now. So yeah, so that's been really interesting, and you know, that whole, I don't know if you want to go into sugar beet, but that is massively interesting. But I think it's a kind of a parable for the wider industry. You know, farmers have to work together and have to have some kind of solidarity, and not just trying to undercut each other, let alone ourselves, because we're facing these corporations and people who are playing by different rules, and we'll always end up on the wrong side of that unless we can summon some collective work.
Yeah, I guess sort of representing 3,000 different growers there. I mean, one of the reasons why I started this podcast, and one of the reasons why you and I both do some of the work we do with sort of engaging with the wider media and the public, is that often people sort of refer to farmers as one sort of big homogenous mass, but every single one of those 3,000 just sugar beet growers will have a different business, a different opinions, different family situations. Some will be small growers, some will be large scale growers. I guess that's part of the challenge, but also what makes it interesting, I suppose, representing all those different people.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you get people who grow, I think the lowest contract's about 30 or 40 acres of sugar beet, and I think the largest one is up to 60,000 tons of sugar beet a year. So I mean, you know, there's massive diversity, but all of them have to use the same contract, and that's the thing that we negotiate. So there's always, no matter how different we are, there are some things which are basic, isn't it? And then you know, people can decide on their own farms whether to grow certain crops or not grow certain crops and all the rest of it. But still, there's a lot more that we've got in common.
Yeah.
No matter what else is different. And that is where we have to focus, I think.
Yeah, sure. And I mentioned some of the wider media stuff you do. You write an excellent column in the Farmers Guardian regularly. Do you enjoy doing that? Do you find it difficult? So, because I do a bit of writing as well, and sometimes I find it incredibly difficult. But sometimes they come quite easily as well. So what about you?
I find it incredibly hard. Incredibly hard. I hate it.
Are you someone who's very organized with it? Are you sort of planning it, have it done 2 weeks in advance? Because I'm not.
No, absolutely not. And often there's a late night involved. Or two. Some of them have come very easily. Mm-hmm. One of them, I remember very clearly, I just sat down and wrote in an hour, although I'd been thinking about it for a long time. But yeah, you have to be quite organized and think about what you might want to say coming up. But no, I think, you know, I enjoy it. I do enjoy it when it's done.
Yeah.
And I'm usually proud. But I think you're quite a perfectionist. I spend hours over them. You know, even when they're finished, I'd reread and edit and edit and edit. And the amount of hours I put in, and I do it free, and you wonder why.
But it's
all part of what you said about communicating with people and a bit of variety. It stops you getting bored, and it does force me to think more widely about who I'm talking to. What have I got to say that might be interesting to someone? And so much of the problem is that so much of what I have to say is so dull or so niche interest that actually finding things that might be of interest to more than myself or three other people is the challenge. Yeah, I find it quite hard. I do think it's worth the effort. I do enjoy it. And I had a bit of a background in journalism, I think, as I mentioned earlier. So I do enjoy it, but I get no reward for it whatsoever, apart from the satisfaction of
the kudos. You do it for the love. All right, Tom. Well, I've probably kept you long enough because we've established you are a very busy man. So let's finish this off in the traditional way with five hard-hitting questions. What is your all-time favourite song?
Sit Down by James.
Oh, what an absolute banger. That is a brilliant choice.
It's like an anthem of my youth, but the more and more I listen to it, and I keep going back to it, it's kind of an anthem for life, actually. It's quite a simple song. It's only like two or three verses, and it's a lot of repetition. And people might say, oh, yeah, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down. But actually, if you listen to the words, they're quite meaningful. But also then... it's quite stirring. It's but in that sort of 90s kind of way.
Yeah, brilliant. So I very clearly remember, being in kind of mid to late 90s in Ibiza at a water party, and that song came on, and it takes me back. Okay, God, that's a 90s reference, isn't it?
Yeah, our age.
What famous historical figure would you most like to go for a pint with?
I'm glad you warned me about this question because I had really struggled with it. And I came up with loads of people because they're so, I mean, it would just be really interesting, wouldn't it? But then I sort of going for a pint was the tincture, because I think actually to be a famous historical figure, you probably have to be a bit of a nightmare.
So
Darwin, Edison, Genghis Khan, I thought all these people, But actually, I thought I would rather go for a pint with someone who wasn't famous and historical. I'd like to meet and have a drink with my great-grandparents.
Yeah, okay. That's it.
And actually, that would be much more meaningful and interesting, I think, to find out what kind of people they were and what they thought about stuff.
Brilliant answer. Okay. You're on a karaoke bar on a night out. Let's assume coronavirus hasn't happened. There's a chance to win a big cash prize. You've had a few drinks. You're feeling confident. What song are you backing yourself to sing?
Well, I think I would, and this is assuming I've had a few drinks, but I would, much to everybody's revulsion, I think I would want to do a duet with my wife. And we would probably, my wife is, it'd be revolting because we'd be sickly anyway, but... my wife can't sing.
Okay.
Bless her. She's a wonderful person. She is tone deaf. And so we would sing probably Islands in the Stream by Dolly Parton. And
what a brilliant choice. That's amazing. Okay. Love that. What's the best book you've ever read?
Fiction, The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. Was very, very good. Non-fiction, there's a pair of books written by a guy called Jared Diamond. One is called Guns, Germs and Steel, and the other is called Collapse. And they're all about why the world is like it is and what things happened and what things can go wrong in terms of human civilization. That was, I think it's had a lasting effect on me. It's kind of a two-volume book, the two separate books, but I think you have to read them together.
Sure. All right. I will check those out. And lastly, then, a traditional way to end, what is your favourite agriculture-related social media account to follow and why?
This is a really cruel question, isn't it? Because there's so many. And actually, it changes constantly because, I'm on Twitter too much. And, you're constantly finding new ones. But there's definitely the best agricultural journalist in this country by a country mile is Abby Kay.
Yeah.
And I would follow her without question. If you're not following her already, definitely follow her, because she's on it. She's absolutely on it. But then if you want to...
Abby is the only person, the only account on Twitter that I have notifications set up for when she tweets. And she knows, I've told her that.
I'm not even that, but I'm not that much of a fan.
I'm a super fan.
But then if you're a farmer, then you're really interested in a weather account to follow. And actually the best one I find is WeatherQuest UK or Dan Holly. And they're actually the only honest weather forecasters in the business, I think, as well.
Yeah, there's not many of them around. No. Just looking out the window now, especially not. Tom, it's been a pleasure. You're a very busy man, so thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. Good luck with the rest of Harvest, and hopefully we'll get to catch up again soon.
Thank you. Well, it's been a great privilege. Thank you for wanting to listen to my meanderings.
And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.